write a song up. We want to welcome you to this very timely evening talk entitled Our Relationship to Politics, Navigating Views of Us and Them, with our beloved teacher, Ryan Massage. And first, as a sangha, we really want to offer our thanks to the Presbyterian Church for offering this beautiful space to us, and also for their deep commitment to going beyond polarization. And I really feel that this church and this community has done such a beautiful job of that, and we're utterly grateful to be here for that. Just a few words about Brian. He's been coming here to Salida for 10 years now to lead meditation retreats for the Salida Sangha. And Sangha simply means community, for those of you that don't know, and it's a Buddhist term. He's been teaching Buddhist meditation since 2000, and he studied in the Zen, the Theravadan, and the Tibetan schools of Buddhism. He leads retreats and teaches meditation courses nationwide. And he's come twice a year now for over 10 years. He might be 11. So we're grateful to have him here tonight. And then finally, following the 2,500-year-old tradition of Buddhist offering these teachings freely, Brian does offer these teachings freely because they're considered priceless. But in order for Brian to continue doing this, we offer what is called in the Buddhist tradition dana, or donation. There's a little box out there, a basket out there. If you feel moved to, please, we gratefully accept that offering for Brian, but it is not expected. So without further ado, Brian.
So again, I just want to welcome you once again to this talk, and I too want to thank the Salida Sangha. I just want to name, it's such a sweet experience for me to come back again and again here to Salida, and also the Presbyterian Church for allowing us to use this space. You probably know, it's, under 2 months now, until those elections in November. And so often around these elections, have you noticed how things can kind of get amped up, especially inside around politics and those conversations? And this is one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk about politics, is just because it's the season. And quite honestly, the reason why I wanted to give this talk about politics is because it's such a challenge for me. I think so many of the talks I give are mostly just confessions of my own difficulties and challenges. And then the nice thing about what I do is I get to make a talk about it. And then people come and listen to my challenges and things like that. So I want to acknowledge that what I'm sharing with you, really, I'm just right there with you. And that's why I wanted to start talking down here rather than up there, because I too really struggle with this. And I found that when I make it a part of my spiritual practice, it becomes something more than just a mere struggle in my life. It becomes some kind of a movement forward when I make that struggle into something deeper. So where I'd like to begin is seeing if we can find a different place to engage in politics. And I want to talk about sometimes the usual places we begin and offer a different place that I think Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, invites us to begin, or gives a different foundation. Often when we reflect and engage in political discussions, in that whole world of politics, you might notice, like I do, sometimes we begin with what we value. We get a sense of valuing something like democracy, please come on in, and or equality, or justice. Or we might get clear about where we stand in terms of politics, in terms of where we balance the rights of an individual compared to where the rights of a state come in and how they intersect or don't intersect. And a lot of times from those values, then we take a stand and we look out onto the world. And it's interesting, I feel that the Buddha began in a different place. And to remember, 2,600 years ago, there was a tremendous amount of political turmoil that was going on in India, which I'll get into a little bit later. Where did the Buddha begin? He began with, you could say, our lived human experience. And in a particular flavor of our lived human experience, namely that part of being a human being is to suffer. It's the experience, difficulty, or challenge. For example, is there anyone here who has not suffered, who has not experienced difficulty or challenge? Have you noticed that that's what can bring us together right here? And that you know that when I use the word suffering or difficulty or challenge, probably you could think of times in your life where you experienced that on so many different levels. It could be the suffering around our bodies and health, interpersonal challenges, the suffering of that around loss, to so many more. And what's so interesting about starting there, this is, I think, very interesting just in terms of a spiritual tradition, it's not starting on a philosophical stance or a belief. So he's not saying, okay, let's start with, can you believe this? Or this is my philosophical perspective. Or this is my idea of how the world began. Or some idea or value. He's not even starting with what Buddhism is so well known for, with non-harming. Not starting there, but with this lived human experience. And right, you don't have to think about it. You know it. And you know it from your own direct experience. And what I'm referring to is a basic teaching that you find in Buddhism called the Four Noble Truths. And the first, or sometimes it's translated as the Four Ennobling Truths. These things that can ennoble us in terms of a spiritual life. And the first noble truth is this simple statement that there is suffering, there is challenge in being a human being. And it doesn't deny that there are joys and happiness and the experiences of bliss. It's just acknowledging a particular aspect about being human. And then the second noble truth is really looking what arises with that suffering that we might have some agency around. And looking that it's really these unskillful habits of the mind that suffering and difficulty can arise. And then the third ennobling truth is coming to see that when that that co-arising or that origination of that suffering stops, there can be more ease in our life. The challenge and the difficulty can cease. And the fourth noble truth is there's a way, there's this path that we can follow towards this freedom. So we begin there, and not only to begin there, this first noble truth is this invitation. Can you touch that? Can you touch your own difficulty, your own challenge in a deep way? Because you might notice that when you touch into your own difficulty, to really sense into that, just in terms of being a human being, and having the capacity to touch that, to touch what I call your humanness, it creates the ability so I can touch the suffering of others, that I can really get that I can touch their humanness. And so much of this practice that comes with the spiritual path, namely meditation, this ability to begin to be with our experience, opens up this possibility to touch suffering in a skillful way. And when I touch it skillfully, there can be clarity and compassion that arises from that, and then I can touch the suffering of the other. Which I think the Trappist monk Thomas Merton put it well. Somebody asked him, you know, since he lived most of his life in a Benedictine monastery, somebody said to him, basically, so what's up with all the suffering in your life? He says, the spiritual life is not so much about suffering, it's actually learning how to suffer effectively. Because in some ways we don't get to choose the difficulties and challenges, yet we can learn how to do it effectively. And in this context, can you effectively learn how to touch into that, to be with that, so a quality of clarity and compassion can arise? So what would it look like, and what would it be like to start the political discourse there? That I'm a human being, just like every other human being that suffers, that has challenges. And I don't mean this to say, to try to dismiss differences, right? Differences are important to see and to acknowledge, and so much difference just in this room. But it's one place that we can come together. And you might hear in this allows for a kind of connection. So let's see what where this might lead. What I noticed in my own spiritual practice, when I can begin to have the skill of sensing into my own difficulty effectively, that gives rise to compassion and clarity. One place that it informs, which is so important for politics, is it informs how I hold my views, which is so important, I find, when I engage with others or look upon what I'm going to call the other, the people who I see as the them, that is not part of the us. And so I want to be really clear about how it helps me navigate the world of views and give the way I usually hold my views. And you might be able to relate to this. So I have my views, and I want to point out that they're the right views. So I want to be really clear about that. And if your views don't line up with mine, it means that you have the wrong views. And what I'm looking for is I'm looking for people to affirm my world and my views. That's the world I want. And I want to tell you that the world would be so great if everybody had my views. Because that's what it feels like, right? Wouldn't the world be great if everybody had your views? And then what happens is when I interact with people that don't have my views, often I just try to be like a superficial good person, and maybe I just stay silent, but I'm really wishing they'd have my views. I'm just trying to be polite. That's about it, you know, not to get in that fight that you're going to regret the next day. Can you relate to this? Is this what I mean? And the image I want to give, this kind of proposal, I'll get into it, is that the Buddha, there's a collection of his teachings called the Dhammapada, and in one he has this beautiful image of holding the teachings, not even holding teachings, the views, like you would hold something called, like you would hold kusa grass. And if you think you're, even if you're out here in Salida, if you imagine holding a bunch of grass, it would be important to do it skillfully, because you could hold that grass in a way that you actually could get cut in a manner. But if you hold it skillfully, you wouldn't get cut. In the same way, can I hold my views in a way that I don't cut myself or others, yet I still have views? But it requires a different relationship to views, right? If I'm so holding onto them so tightly, all that's going to happen is misery for myself and others. So how do I hold the kusa grass differently? How do I go about this? So I have this basis, right? Touching into humanness. navigating difficulty effectively. It informing how I hold views. So in what way? And to help situate this, I want to use a quote from the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, who said, "Well, nothing is easier than to denounce the wrongdoer. Nothing is more important and difficult than to understand them." Nothing is easier than to denounce the wrongdoer or the person who doesn't hold your political views. Well, nothing is more important and nothing is more difficult than to understand them. Have you noticed this? It's so easy to denounce. And have you noticed the challenges maybe just around this political climate to understand what I'm going to call the other? It's challenging, isn't it? I find, you know, this mind of mine, I love to spend my time denouncing. I have to slow down to actually have the willingness to understand. And I'll get into why that can be so challenging, because I think it's important to see what is underlying some of this challenge. And I want to point out that often we are situated in a mainstream society that doesn't support this. So one example of this, I had a friend who, he got a new small wood stove, really beautiful wood stove. He's living up in the Northwest. Went to work and somebody broke into his place and stole his wood stove. And it's pretty smart. He actually looked on Craigslist and there it was. So he was selling his wood stove. So he called the police and they arrested the fellow who had stole his wood stove. And the local news station got really interested in this. So they went and interviewed him. And I remember seeing the uncut version of this. And I appreciated what he was sharing in this interview. You know, he was saying, I do want to hold this person accountable for their actions. But he also said, you know, I know where he's coming from. I used to live that same kind of life. And I know the difficulty that he's coming from. And I know the kind of conditions that can lead one to that kind of behavior. So I get it. I get the kind of the social conditions and the social context within which such kind of behavior arises. And he said, I think it's so important in these situations that we, you know, address the behavior, but also to understand it. It's really quite beautiful. And for the news show, they cut all of that out. And the whole story was how he caught the bad guy on Craigslist. Isn't that interesting? It's what sells. It keeps it so simple for our life and our minds. And yet, I want to propose it's quite dangerous, that kind of narrative that we're always fed. And I want to point out that it's, I'd love to blame it just on society, but it's not true. I notice my own mind do this, how I can have a simplistic view of what I'm going to call the other being the one, that person that doesn't hold one. This was last year, a couple years ago. We were celebrating my wife's birthday, and all the family got together, and I was hanging out with my brother-in-law, and which in some ways I enjoy to do. He studies philosophy, and we talk about philosophy, and but also he has very different views than me. He worked for a think tank under Dick Cheney, and he has different political views than where I came from. And we were talking a little bit about political philosophy, and I mentioned Karl Marx's important work called Das Kapital, and talking about Marx's critique of capitalism. And almost in mid-sentence, I appreciated what he said. I almost felt like he knew what I was getting at, or he knew what I was doing. And he looked at me and he said, "Brian, just because I worked for a Republican administration doesn't mean I think like them." And that was so helpful to remember. Because what I had done is I boxed him in. I thought I knew what he thought, what he believed, how he understood the world. I had no idea. I still don't have any idea. Because that changes, right? It changes for people. day after day, year after year. In some ways, I really wasn't interested in hearing his viewpoint because I had boxed him in. And I want to point out how quickly this happens in our minds, because this is so important. So much of Buddhism is actually, the heart of it is examining how our minds function, because that's where the freedom is. Because when I can see that clearly, I can start to unhook from it. Another example, I was walking down the street in Flagstaff, and it was, could have been maybe around this time of year, election season. And I was walking past a house, and they had a sign up of the politician that I did not want to vote for, that I did not like. And in a moment, I had the thought, I don't like those people that live there. I had no idea who lived there. I had no idea how many people lived there. I had no idea if there was anybody in the house. Yet, so immediately, my mind felt like I knew something about those people, something deep down inside. All my mind had seen was a sign that had certain letters on it. That's all it saw, with colors, and then it created this whole story. You ever notice this? So let's get it a little more subtle. Don't worry, we'll get to do this. So my wife and I were in Boston, and we went to, I don't know if anybody's been to the Science Museum there, which is so much fun. And we were walking around, and someone was giving a lecture about, well, let me share with you the research that this speaker was talking to us about. She said that there is this research they had done where they had people take a shower and only use unscented products, like shampoo and soap. And then they had each of the participants put like a kind of a pad or a cotton pad underneath their armpits, and they keep it there for 24 hours. It's a whole group of participants. And then they collected all the pads and somehow put that scent or the pad itself in all these vials. And they also had each participant share if they identified as a Democrat or a Republican. Okay, so they had this with each scent. And then what they did is then they had, I don't know if it was the same participants or a whole group of participants, smell the scent in each of these smiles. And the people who were smelling, who identified as Democrats, overwhelmingly preferred the scent of other Democrats. And Republicans overwhelmingly preferred the scent of other Republicans. Isn't that a trip? And that's hard to believe, huh? Not the vials, no, it's just completely, yeah. So I want to point out how subtle this is, because I think it's important to see how our biology works, and we'll come back to this. Because if it's working on that subtle level, it's so important for me to learn how to slow down and get a broader view of the person in front of me. And there could be biological reasons for this, right? In terms of the creation of tribe, which might be helpful, but also creates this us and them. Yet what I find when I slow down, if I begin to be with my own challenge and difficulty, my own suffering, I can open up to the suffering of the other, and there's the connection. And having that as a basis can help counteract some of this. But I do want to name how subtle this is. And actually, maybe we could take some time with these images. Cindy, could you bring up the images? So I want to point out something about images and how our minds work, because I think it's quite striking. I'll just go from the beginning.
Yeah. Let me try again.
Okay. And if you could hit pause somehow.
Oops.
Just go back, maybe. So. Great, maybe one, yeah.
Oh, there.
So I want us to slow down just with this image, because I also want to point out that how our mind quickly makes associative links can be very helpful also. It can be inspiring for some people, depending upon the picture. But we have Martin Luther King here, and you might notice, if you take some time to take in Martin Luther King, especially in that picture, it can evoke the values that we really appreciate, and it can be moving in some kind of manner. And then the next one, we'll just go through these. Or Rosa Parks, beginning the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. It can evoke something that represents something to us, which is so important. And then onward. Or Nelson Mandela, when you really slow down with that, it can have that same quality. He represents something. And the next one, Mahatma Gandhi. And then again, Cindy. Like the Dalai Lama. Just that smile, huh? Body something. And I want to point out something about this. If I was showing this in Beijing or China, and you had been influenced by their media compared to our media, and I want to say in some ways this is just influenced by media, you might have a very different impression of this and what it evokes for you. Archbishop Romero. And then again. Some of you might know Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani woman who, she's the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. And she wrote about, she was the one who was shot by the Taliban, survived, and then has really been a spokesperson for the education of girls. And then onward. And then it might change some of you. It might change some, and for some of you, no. But to see what it evokes, and then onward. And then something else. And this is, I think, where it gets important, because in some ways, this is the tricky arena of politics, is in some ways, images, especially of political figures, in some ways, the way politics work is they begin to represent something depending on what side of the spectrum that you're on. And yet, are you starting to see what I'm beginning to share, how dangerous that is? Because if I start here with the associative links around the image rather than our collected shared human experience, then I can't have a conversation. I'm not going to hold my views skillfully. Because this is just a representation that we've been fed. I mean, how many here have met this person in this image? Nobody's met him. And then onward. But it's tough, isn't it? It really can be even guttural. And then onward. And then the next one. And then one more time, actually. And then to see what gets evoked by this. It is kind of interesting, though, how things get stirred, right? Especially in these months. These are just images. And I want to be sensitive, and I want to acknowledge that, but I also want to be in a place where this doesn't flood me. Because once I'm flooded, I'm holding the kusagrass so tightly. So I want to point out, when I say my views, I'm talking about something really deep. I'm talking about something that's almost biological here. That is biological. And then onward. Noticing what happens. And again. And one more. You can just turn that off now, Cindy. Thank you. Yeah. So again, I think the promise of a spiritual path is I can even relate to those things differently. It's not like I'm stopping that process. It's not like I'm trying to get to a place where I like an image or I find it pleasant. I'm not trying to get to a place where I don't have views It has to do with how I relate to them. So there can be a different relationship to the way I hold the views. We're still human beings. It's just that, can we find the opening to navigate our humanness in a different way? So I want to go back to our basics, the foundation. Truly touching what it is to be a human being in terms of challenge and difficulty. And as Thomas Merton said, not merely just suffering, because that doesn't lead to anything, but effectively. To touch it skillfully and effectively. To be with it, that informs us, that leads to clarity and compassion. What else arises when we start here? So it's interesting, when the really, very basically, the Buddha said that suffering arises from ignorance or delusion. And I think that's what he's also inviting us to do, is that when you touch into your suffering, especially that mind-created suffering, you might notice that it comes from a kind of delusion about the way things are. And it could be around so many different things. When I get up in the morning and I turn on my computer and it breaks, and I'm pissed off, it's because I think computers shouldn't break. I should have the one computer in the world that never breaks. And I get bummed out when it's not. Because I'm bumping against the way things are. Things break. Yet I don't deeply understand. It's a kind of delusion that I feel like things should be constant in some kind of manner, stable. It comes from my ignorance. So in this kind of investigation of suffering, what I begin to realize is that this word evil doesn't really fit. There's not a place for evil. The Buddha actually never talks about evil people or evil things. It's simply noticing this dynamic that from delusion or ignorance, that is what gives rise to suffering. And I want to point out that I'm quite certain that this is something that the Buddha considered. Just to go back to the history, during the Buddha's time, there was, as I said, there was a serious political upheaval. They said that the way that the political power was situated 2,600 years ago in India is that the power was basically divided up into these small republics. And actually, he came from one republic called the Sakyan clan. That's what he's called, also Shakyamuni or Sakyamuni. But during his lifetime, these bigger powers started to overwhelm and demolish the republics to have these bigger, you could say, nation states during this time. And so he saw a tremendous amount of violence. For example, King Bimbisara, who was a king who supported him, he saw the king's son basically murder him to take the throne. Also, the Sakyan clan, later on in the Buddha's life, was basically annihilated from another king that had a vendetta against them. His own tribe was demolished through this political turmoil. And the other interesting thing is that many of you might know that the common story of the Buddha is that he grew up in a palace. And as a result of growing up in a palace around all this opulence, he then decided to go explore the spiritual life. There's actually a lot of doubt how true that is. And what you find when they've done a lot of scholarship around this is that in kind of the earliest strata of some of the Buddhist scriptures, you find this poetic expression of what drives him to practice. And what he says is, he said, by looking around me and witnessing all of this violence, there was a kind of fear in my heart. In experiencing that violence, I started to have the desire to take out the thorn from the heart that causes such violence. I want to point this out to say that I feel like when he was creating the spiritual path, he was probably moved by the social unrest of his time, by the political upheaval, by politics. So he wasn't hanging out in some cave. He had an experience like you and me. So back to this evil. What can be so problematic about the idea of evil, if I start there, is that it dehumanizes. I can't relate to that so much. But suffering, I can. So the Russian writer, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who some of you might know, he was quite a vocal critic during dangerous times in Russia during the Stalin era, really of the Gulag, which were these forced labor camps. He puts it well, he says, if only there were evil people somewhere, insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? That's a different understanding. And it would be so much easier, don't you think, if there were just somehow some evil people out there that we could separate from the rest of us, and that would be the solution. And I want to point out, it's tricky, our minds really gravitate to this. Have you seen so often in like popular movies or popular tales, it's this fight between the good ones and the bad ones. And it can reinforce this idea of good and evil. But the world may not be that way. It might be that there's just these bunch of human beings that are struggling with suffering in these different ways. Can we touch into that as a beginning place? So we're not getting lost in us and them. And again, I'm going to name, there is a place for the narrative and the construction of us and them. It can really point out important differences so that we all also don't get lost in just like me. But it can also be problematic. Again, how do you hold it in terms of the Kusagrass? Again, just back to how challenging this can be. What I notice is I think this can be also challenging if we've been deeply hurt, or you could say, or our tribe has been deeply hurt, and for complex reasons. So there's also pressures sometimes outside of us that can really shape how we view things. For example, at Stanford University, they did a psychological test where they took a group of pro-Israeli students and pro-Arab students. And what they did is they showed them the exact same news clips. And the pro-Israeli students were convinced that the news clips were anti-Israeli. And the pro-Arab students felt like it was anti-Arab. Same news clips. It shapes how I view, it shapes how I hear. I can't hear the other if I begin there. I find it at least opens up the door for doing that difficult task if I can touch into the suffering of my own experience and the suffering of the other. And again, I want to point out that I'm not advocating that we're trying to get to a place where we all agree. It's getting to a place where we can disagree and not be so divisive. Actually, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's such a history of debate, I love what they say. They say, where there is agreement, there you find fools. And I appreciate that. How can we skillfully disagree? How can we hold views so we can disagree? And I think that's the promise of the ideal of something like democracy, is to have places of disagreement, but not unskillful divisiveness. Some other examples, just to see these dynamics. Another story, I think I got this from a NPR show I was listening to. There was a former Israeli soldier, and he grew up in a quite religious and nationalist family, and he was actually named after a soldier who had died in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. So it was a family that was very dedicated to the Israeli cause. And he joined a group of Israeli soldiers and veterans called Breaking the Silence. Some of you might know this group. And it was a group where he began to share some of the unskillful things, the atrocities that happened in the occupied territories. And as a result of that, he was named a traitor of the state, which I think was so devastating for him, especially for the family that he came from. And also on the other side, you see this, there is a professor at Al-Quds University, a Palestinian professor, who decided to take a group of Palestinian students to Auschwitz and Birkenau, the concentration camps, really to see if they could touch humanness, the dilemma of human suffering, to touch the other. And it was really profound for the students. And when he got back, he actually received death threats when he was at Al-Quds University and had to leave. And I was so moved by this story that I went online and I was looking at the different responses to it. It was amazing, this touching story of the attempt at compassion, and all the statements were either pro-Israeli or pro-Arab. It's like, wow, can we listen? Can you hold views differently? And I think the Buddha sees political turmoil. That's why I think he has this at the heart of the freedom. As he says, this is what happens. He says, when one does not understand things as they really are, to touch into our lived human experience, then this lust for views, this infatuation with views, a passion for views, attachment to views, this craving for views lie deep within one in regard to views. This is called the bond of views. And then he speaks to his own freedom. He says, this I do declare, after investigation, there is nothing among views that such as one as I would get entangled with. Seeing misery in views without adopting any of them, searching for the truth, I saw inward peace. I think this speaks to an essential part of a spiritual practice. Can I touch into this quality of humanness, but also learn to begin to step out of my own world to understand the other, another's world? To actually begin to ask questions, to connect, rather than to have the stance of I'm right. Because it's so addictive. Have you noticed how addictive it is to simply be the right one? So what could this look like, to have the views but not be entangled with them in the same way? So I want to give one example of this. And in some ways, I hesitate to give an example of this. I think it's important to, so there's some kind of inspiration. But I also don't want to simplify it. This is a tricky arena. But I think it's possible to navigate the world differently. And this happened in Flagstaff a number of years ago. There was a judge, Judge Hatch, and she was presiding over a court case. There was a man who had sexually assaulted a woman in a bar in Flagstaff. It went to court, and the man was easily convicted of sexual assault. It was a very clear, actually simple case. But as the conviction was read out, the judge decided to lecture the woman about, if she had not been in the bar that night, it never would have happened. I just want to point out, it's kind of crazy. And actually, there were a lot of national protests around this. I assume that we're, just to give one perspective on this, it would be like somebody who had been shot in a drive-by shooting telling them it happened because they didn't have bulletproof windows. The law just doesn't work that way in terms of that. It's not a law, it's not a legal system where we blame the victim of this, that actually we would want to cultivate a society where it's actually safe to go out at night for everyone. And there were a lot of protests, which I'm not saying either way, they were good or bad or anything like that. There was a lot of outcry. But there was this one woman, really interesting, actually my wife was working with her, I think at the time this was happening, and she had a connection with one of the higher ups in the judicial system, I think it was in our county. And she spent a lot of time just connecting with them, and basically, with conversation, convinced them how great it would be to educate judges in our county around situations like this. How to skillfully know some of the nuances around these kinds of crimes, especially crimes against women. And as a result of that, she got another organization involved, and this organization came in, and this judge made it mandatory for all the judges in this county to get educated around these kinds of topics. What I appreciate about this example is that she went back to, oh, there's some ignorance, there's delusion here. How can I address it skillfully? Where's a place of coming together to take it on that level, rather than getting lost in us and them? So again, can we start somewhere else to touch into our suffering effectively in a way that we can still disagree and agree, but in a way that doesn't cause so much suffering? So may this lead to the freedom of all beings. Thank you.
I was listening to public radio yesterday, and a man in Germany had figured out that trees talk to each other, and that they have feelings, and that they nurture their children, and that they keep old trees alive. And this is done through their root system. And it's a fascinating thing to think about, but one of the things that we're learning about it is that the exchange of feelings and knowledge among trees is extremely slow. And if there isn't something to be considered about relationships, and I tend to want instant gratification in my life, but don't we sometimes have to wait?
Oh, I see. Thank you so much. What a beautiful image, huh? Yeah, it might be a little bit slower as trees, huh? Just to acknowledge that, or to acknowledge that that's also how the way things are, that it might be much slower than we want it to be. Yeah. Thanks for doing that. Really appreciate it. And I love the image and the story. Yeah. Anything else? One more here.
So you mentioned the biology behind. Mm-hmm. Democratic and Republican Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're always wrestling with this biology. How do we not overcome it, but help it guide us.
Yeah, I think some of that, I mean, just how we use this image is maybe it's just spreading our roots farther. Because the, you know, tribalism is strong just given our evolutionary history. Yet that tribe can expand, and if I have that tribal notion that encompasses so much more, there can be that altruistic intention that comes in tribe. So sometimes I think it's this two thing of expanding the tribe, but also being aware when my mind is getting hooked by us and them, so that I can start to slowly begin to find a different route. And the way sometimes I do this, I'll just be honest with you, when I'm in a challenging situation, sometimes I'll just tell myself, can I make sure that the most important thing is to only connect? Like, for example, I was on a plane and I was sitting next to a woman who went to Wheaton College. And I don't know if anybody knows of Wheaton College. I just want to point out it's a little bit different political view than me. It's a very conservative, fundamentalist Christian college. And I don't know how this happened. I didn't mean to. We started talking about politics. I don't know what I was thinking. But there it was. I really appreciate it. She was really clear about what she thought about things. And it was so wonderful to remember what's important here is just to connect, to really connect. And it wasn't me. It didn't mean that I backed away from with disagreeing from her. But when we had that as the basis, which she was willing to follow, it was actually quite sweet to be able to hang out together and to get into some things that we disagreed and agreed with. And that's what I needed, as I remember. I needed to remember, yeah, she's part of my tribe. Yeah. Uh-huh, I never really.
So more in a political, you know, in our time sometimes it happens.
So I think what's important is intention. Because that's what I have agency over, is my intention. But if I get lost in expectation, just my life is miserable. And I think it really helps me realize the power of intention. So the Dalai Lama put it well. He said, you know, some people think I'm a god king. You know, some people think I'm this something that's beyond human. And he said, and others, I think he was talking a lot of to the Chinese political system, think I'm just a monk in wolf's clothing. A man of deception. And he says, but what matters to me is not that. When I check in with my intention, and if that is clear, that's what's important, and that is all. And I think that's really quite powerful. And I think he's a great example of that. If you think about how little movement there has been with China around occupied Tibet, which in many ways is probably gotten worse over the years in terms of human rights situations. But he's clear about being very clear about his intention. I think that's what makes it, because I think you're, as you said, you know, I don't know how long this is going to take, and I don't have control over that. Yeah. But thank you for mentioning that. Yeah. Okay, thank you everyone. Thank you for the evening. I really appreciate it. And, good luck out there with the elections.